So anyway, I thought, as I was reading through stuff about this, that there were really two separate issues, one of which, it seems to me, is more familiar to the kinds of discussions we've had, and that would be using emergence, complexity, networks, etc., as a way to understand what happens, you know, on the ground in a situation like Katrina in New Orleans, or emergencies in general. And there are some interesting things to think about, but that seems to me is also involves conversations we've already had on some level. The thing that it seems to me we've talked about less, that was the other thing that occurred to me down below the fold here, is thinking about emergence as a strategy for response. In other words, what you'd almost call applied emergence or emergence policy. And there's been a lot of kind of interesting stuff burbling up in the wake of Katrina along those lines. You know, are there ways to deliberately engineer what you might call an emergent response to an emergent situation? But this is, I was looking a lot at Watts last night and actually earlier this week, you know, and he has a lot of things to say that are, you know, both conceptually interesting and useful in terms of ways to describe a situation like Katrina, you know, in causal terms, in terms of understanding it in a paradigmatic way differently than most people would. And it's usually one of the pluses of a lot of the kinds of things that we've done as a description of events in the world, particularly human events, is that, you know, emergence goes back to the sort of sum of the parts thing, you know, kind of refuses to disaggregate in the way that a lot of other styles of social explanation insist upon doing. It sort of says you have to have all these things in motion at once. It's the interaction, the parallel interaction of so many different things that in fact makes the situation what it is, that you can't sort of disaggregate and pull apart. And then I made a list actually of like all the disaggregations that people are performing, all these sorts of stories that go on. And what you get, I mean, what we've seen since the event is lots of people strongly insisting, in many cases, on just one of these stories. And at best, in many cases, insisting on two or three. You know, it's this plus this plus this, and that's the story. Whereas it seems to me an emergent explanation would kind of say it's in some sense, most or all of these things acting in parallel and producing an outcome, you know, that where it's the outcome that's exceptional and interesting and a sort of structure of complexity that's a result of all these small initial conditions interacting in ways that really, in one sense, are unpredictable or unanticipated.
One thing about this sort of list is also what you mean by why. If you're in the business of quote blaming things, right? And there's a sense in which, you know, like the fifth one in your list or sixth, it was the strength of Katrina. I mean, there's an obvious sense in which if Katrina was a Category 1 or something, none of this would have happened. That's not terribly interesting. But so, you know, issues about what one means. Does one mean, well, it was just that bit stronger than we ought to have anticipated, or, you know? So, I mean, each of these, I think itself, if you're going for a sort of counterfactual idea of pinpointing quote causes, there's also the question about how one's varying the thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it wasn't like, if Michael Brown hadn't been in charge, but some other equally incompetent Bush crony, you know, the same thing might have happened, right? That doesn't mean he wasn't partly responsible.
He doesn't think he was responsible.
Well, it's a debatable proposition, actually.
The more general point is there are two ways of trying to make sense of events. One of them is the way that presumes that there is a single cause, or at least a single most important cause. And the other one is the way that Tim is offering us as an idea from emergence. That is that by and large, when unusual events happen, they don't happen for reasons that have to do with identifiable single events. The other place where this turns up, and it's very, very practical, is you go back 60 or 70 years ago, when there was an airplane accident, there was always an attempt to locate a cause for the airplane accident. And what's happened in the last 30 or 40 years is airplane accident investigators have A, become sophisticated, and B, now have to function under a whole series of regulations that influence the design of airplanes. And essentially, the design of airplanes has become such that no single event can bring down an airplane. And so the airplane investigators now, when they write an airplane accident report, start from the premise that there can be no single cause. And they represent a web of causation for an airplane accident. The argument here is we ought to be representing a web of causation for events like Katrina.
Yeah, so I think
but
some
does anybody disagree
right,
that,
about.
You know, I mean, historians are all multi-causal. I mean, is there anybody who doesn't think it's multi-causal? I mean...
No, but I think, well, I mean, yeah, at the level of storytelling, you know, in a sense, in general, there are plenty of people that don't. In other words, that the arguments have sort of sprung up around people that have, at best, a kind of dual to triple causal view, or who are weighting one cause so heavily in the moral or political line that they're giving that they push everything else aside. Confronted, you know, I suspect everybody would say, yes, sure, as many things, but it seems to me emergence provisions a story form in the way that we've talked about it that would sort of principally reject trying to tell stories in that fashion and say, you know, you have to have all these things in motion at once, and in fact, you have to have the kind of recursive interaction between agents, in this case, and all sorts of things in their environment that we've seen as a kind of privileged feature of emergence. So, I mean, in this case, for example, one of the concrete things that I've seen described where it seems to me emergence or an agent-based conception of systems and networks is very good at explaining some of what happened is this notion of the relationship between looting, the calculation to stay, the representation of the event as a disaster, the moral narrative that gets told about it in the aftermath. So you get lots of people who, when they're interviewed, say, you know, the calculation to stay was based on a kind of calculation about whether looting was likely. Why did that become important to their calculation? Because in many cases they were people in situations of structural poverty who couldn't replace goods once lost that were precious and difficult to accumulate. And so they assessed whether looting was possible or likely. Then their assessments changed because, in fact, media representations were saying that looting was happening commonly. Even if they didn't directly witness it, they began to think that it, in fact, was more likely than they originally thought. So they made different kinds of decisions about staying. The fact that they were then making those statements caused, you know, in a sense, a whole narrative about rescue and about the need to get people off their roofs because now they're stuck there. You know, I mean, so it seems to me that's a line of explanation that we're privileged to sort of offer that in one sense, you know, gets pushed aside by these other stories that get told.
There is one thing. I mean, I want to come back to Alan's point because I think it's an interesting and important one. As long as one was working or comfortable working in the single variable or small variable mode, to account for things, there was a fairly well worked out set of principles on which to evaluate the story. Now you could use counterfactual principles to say, is this a good story or not? It's not clear to me that when you move into this other way of talking about things, that we have an equally good set of known principles to use to evaluate the quality of the story.
Exactly.
And so the challenge in some ways is that we're going to move to this emergent perspective, we may have to work out a whole new set of evaluative principles to avoid somebody simply saying, oh, it's A through Z, and then ending there.
Worse than that, I think the problem that we face is, in fact, even more fundamental, if at this descriptive level, before we even get to a question of a prescriptive or a policy response, which I think in some ways is the easier problem when it comes to emergence. I can actually think of real concrete things we can talk about prescriptively or as policy that might take emergence as their premise. But descriptively, it seems to me it's very hard to figure out how you would avoid, you know, what I've sort of kind of come to think of as like this great, you know, graduate school kung fu move, you know, which is you go to your first academic conference, you give your very first paper, and what you get up and say is, well, up until now, everybody has had a terribly simple understanding of the problem about which I am writing, but I have a complicated problem, or an understanding. You know, I'm the first one to truly appreciate the complexity of this issue. And there's a way in which, you know, to sort of say, look, it isn't any one of these one stories. Then, you know, somebody says, so what is it? We say, well, it's everything. You know, it's all this stuff. It's all those it's. It's all the interactions of those it's. It's the, you know, and then we're right. We've seen this problem again and again. I mean, to have a descriptive language that goes beyond insisting that emergence is the counter to simple, singular, single variable explanations is really difficult. We can counter it, but then what do we say? Except, well, gosh, it's everything, and it's really complicated.
Yeah, that's the problem.
I think the other confounding factor in coming up with stories is that everyone on the outside who was watching this thing unfold on TV had one perspective, but the people who were in New Orleans had no idea what was going on. They didn't have TV. They had absolutely no idea. So they're operating as interacting agents was in a completely different landscape than the people, the storytellers looking on the outside and watching what these people were doing.
But maybe instead of having a list of causations, maybe a list of interactions would be more towards how you would actually make this useful. Right? And they're still stories, but they're stories about more like links in this web of causality that Paul was talking about, rather than just possible stories that don't include the interactions.
But a story about, I mean, you started out by saying stories are disaggregations that strongly insist on one cause or another. But a story is always a disaggregation.
Yeah.
I mean, a map is always smaller than the world. So there's got to be some,
not if it's a story about the interaction, though. I mean,
the question of the style, that's...
See, I'm not even necessarily, I mean, the thing that, this is why I like Watts, right? I mean, in the language of networks here, is that what you begin to do, perhaps, is rather than telling a story that says, a narrative story that says this happened and then this happened, what you do instead is start drawing a chart that says this node connects to that node. You know, looter connects to police, connects to people being looted, connects to businesses
poverty.
In New Orleans, connects to poverty.
Connects to language,
you know.
The term looting.
Yeah,
the
right, connects to representation, you know, I mean, so that...
But then you can't do, then you really get beyond a linear, you get
yeah,
beyond
that's right.
a linear...
In fact,
I mean,
you almost get stuck in it, it's a kind of uncertainty principle problem. You're either telling the process of what happened, you know, or you are freezing process and giving a simultaneous picture of all the links between the nodes of the network in the situation. But of course, part of the problem is that this is process. I mean, we know that, right? That the
but part of it is also that the story tell, I mean, you tell a story for the satisfaction of having an explanation. And I'm
yeah.
thinking about that tsunami lecture that you gave the first time we
yeah.
did the story
yeah.
of evolution course that took the tsunami and said you could tell it catastrophically, or you could tell it continuously. Well, people like the catastrophic story. I mean, you like a story that's got a cause because there's a satisfaction of saying, aha!
But
know?
They also like, and this is what stories have, people like a story in this context that has an agency, right? In other
exactly.
words, the tsunami
exactly.
story is a little uncomfortable for a lot of people because the best thing anybody could do was, well, nobody build a goddamn warning system.
Right.
But that was pretty limited. Whereas
right.
if you
here
look
you
at
all
almost
possible.
All of these stories,
right.
you know,
they've got
a huge percentage of them attempt to tell a story that has agency in it.
Right,
so
well,
that
because
it's not just Katrina,
cause
it's
we believe
Michael Brown or
that,
FEMA or Bush or
you
looters
know,
or...
You believe that the full extent of the disaster could have been avoided, right? And so you're trying to pinpoint... I mean, this is the premise. I mean, I think Americans, you know, we think this could have been avoided. That the full, not the hurricane itself, obviously, but the totality of the destruction. And it could have been, obviously. You know, there's a lot of ways it could have been. I mean, that's, I think Paul's thing is really, really interesting. Because, you know, what do you do when you have these multi-explanation things, counterfactual? Because if they really all had to happen, just getting one of them out. So like in the New Orleans case, I mean, it's true, had the levees not broken, that would have stopped, that would have been the end of the problem. So, you know, so sometimes there's a cause that's so central, you know, and so I, the way I want to just bring that up, and I'm not an expert in this, and so I wish I knew more. So an accident law, okay? So you can have two views of accidents, and I think you can look at this as an accident. So you can have what I call the John Irving view of accidents, which is that, which is what you were really hypothesizing here, which I got when I, 100 years ago, when I read The World According to Garp, that what an accident is an event that happens, and the cause of the event is a whole bunch of little things that have very low probabilities of risk in and of themselves, and yet all conflate at one moment, and you know, they're always bizarre, but conflate in one moment to create the accident, okay? And to me, that's, I mean, after reading that, that became, in my mind, the paradigmatic view of what an accident really is. That it's these, because an accident is by definition not something that somebody intends. So it's all these little, but yet, even though no one intends it, we think there's causes, we think there's ways it could have been avoided, we think there were risks created that resulted in the accident, but they're all little risks, and it just so happens there's a conflation of all these little risks for the accident to occur, right? But the law, the actual law, tort law, demands, before you can successfully sue somebody, that you prove proximate cause. So they have to, out of this whole plethora of little risks, the law has a way, and this is the part I don't really haven't spent much time thinking about, the law has a way of picking out the proximate cause, and if there is no proximate cause, then you can't successfully sue that other person. So I think it's interesting, the law, which is always dealing with accidents, has a whole methodology to pick out from all these causal things a cause.
Yeah, but how does it pick it out? It picks it out usually through, in a sense, the action of an adversarial advocacy. In other words, two people arguing about different stories.
Yeah, but there's principles.
Well, but it's also reductionist.
Yes.
I mean,
so there's a famous the train case, which with a P, like Pellsgrove versus New York Central or something, where some guy was running down a track, you know, as a passenger, and he was running on the landing, and he tripped, and he threw something, which hit somebody, and it was like a Rube Goldberg accident, and this question was, and somebody was suing the train company, were they really at fault? And I can't even remember how the case was decided, but it was all this whole basis of proximate cause, whether, you know, one way or the other, whether it was the proximate cause of the accident. So I just think that would be an interesting, I haven't spent any time with this, how the law, in looking at accidents, focuses in on, you know, they have a bunch of principles, which they obviously have to have to decide cases, to focuses in on the proximate cause.
So there's going to be two things that one might want to do with these stories in the case of things like accidents. One is to intervene and change things so that whatever kind of thing you think happened is less likely to happen in the future. And so the intervention question is interesting when you have a whole bunch of things that are, in a sense, undifferentiated in a network. And then the second thing is to assign the responsibility, sort of moral responsibility. And that, I think, is where the agency comes in. That's obviously where the law comes in, because you can't sue inanimate things. So, I mean, there you have to make important distinctions between what nodes in your chain involve human agency and what don't. Whereas in just a pure case of intervention, you could just build the levee higher, maybe. And if you thought that was a problem, and you thought it was no one's fault, you know, that would be something you could change, which in its, I mean, you could blame people for not building it high enough or building it shoddily, but the actual intervention there wouldn't be an intervention on agency, it would be an intervention to try and change.
Let me generalize it slightly, because the law case and your point, it depends a little bit on what you're trying to do. I think generalizing the law. As we've been talking, there have been listed a series of reasons telling a story. One is to have explanation. One is to support the concept of agency. One is to adjudicate between competing claims of different people. That's the legal situation. And another is to try and alter the future. It is conceivable that the emergence framework per se doesn't give one a methodology for evaluating stories in and of itself. But the method for evaluating stories, multi-variable stories, is actually critically dependent on the purpose for which the story is being told. And so you could have an emergence understanding. The story that you would draw from the emergence understanding actually depends on the purpose for which you're telling a story.
See, I think the problem is too, though, that the thing which we're trying to, in any sense, tell stories about, either in that sense of purpose or explanation, is in and of itself a story that's a consequence of emergence, i.e., this is what I mean by the question of the it, right? I mean, if this was just a disaster in which 1,100 people died, that would occasion stories and responses and so on. But it's more than that. If it was just an incident in which a city was very badly flooded, well, I mean, Fargo was badly flooded a while back, and there was a lot of attention to that. But I mean, it didn't stick as a national narrative. There wasn't the cover of The Economist that said, you know, the shaming of America. You know, it was just Fargo, and it was just a flood, and it was a river, right? I mean, and there was a sense in which, you know, then there was some of the same harumphing about the Army Corps of Engineers and so on, and was this preventable? But it went away. The sense is here, it seems to me, the problem, the disaster, the it, is partly an interaction of 1,100 people dead, a city flooded, but also the moral stories being told about the event in the first place, you know, the sort of moral parable of what does this show us about ourselves in conditions of disaster, what does this say about the nature of government, you know, a whole set of things. I mean, and so it here, in a sense, is in and of itself a story created by the emergent interaction of a number of things which we are inclined to try and explain. I mean, we always want to explain the deaths of 1,100 people, you know, but sometimes our explanations are relatively simple.
Well, in fact, go back up to your earlier list, because it's very clear that many of these different things are, in fact, in part explanations of why New Orleans became a story.
Yeah.
Which is to say, there are a lot of people who are really pissed at George Bush. That contributed to New Orleans becoming a story, and it's those people who tend to use the single factor story is that George Bush didn't care about black people. There are a lot of people who are unhappy about the media. That's part of what made this a story. In fact, the whole media reaction to this stuff is bizarre. Since PBS, didn't they give PBS following the second hurricane? I mean, they devoted a whole day to what turned out to be a non-story. And they were sort of...
They kept saying Katrina during the whole thing.
And they were fluffing around on the air. Somebody had clearly gotten to them and said, look, hurricanes are stories. You've got to cover them the way you do other things. So you're right, Ken. There were a whole series of different factors at the storytelling level that came together to make this a story.
Well, I don't think that I, as a Mergenot, would want to say at any time that Michael Brown or George Bush is just one player in all these different stories. I would want to say, no, those guys have really big counterfactual connections, and they could do something that would really have changed the outcome of the story. So
I'm not sure
you would like
would
to say
that.
Why would you say that
point.
As
an emergenaut, I don't think you're allowed
to
say
that.
You're allowed to say
actually,
it, but not as an emergenaut.
I think he is sort of, and this really, maybe this is the interesting question, this question of the application of this. You know, is there a different way to respond, to manage, to control, to deal with? I mean, and this is where the network material has a language that sort of begins to say, look, you know, it is, a network is how you have to understand complex systems and events within complex systems. But there's a difference between different nodes of a network. And that, for example, highly connected nodes in a scale-free network are intensely vulnerable. So that a scale-free network is really robust in the face of random events, but it's not robust at all when it's attacked, you know, with some special intensity at highly connected nodes. I mean, that there's an architecture to networks, to the quality of connections between things that we could begin to talk about that, for one, would give us, again, a predictive language about what are the design features of certain kinds of complex systems that produce particular kinds of cascades, that produce particular kinds of really bad things in the world, and then, you know, is there something to be done about that?
It would be, it's useful as a framework to identify the best possible course of action. You're always going to have to find one or two things to put your effort into, and it seems like this network analysis is exactly what the application is to find the node that would be the best priority to work at.
Well, go on. I still don't see how you could do a story that would represent that.
I agree. The representation problem is a different, I mean, in a way that's, I don't have the answer to that because I don't know how to tell the story of these things. You know? That in a sense, the problem we've seen again and again with a lot of emergence in a descriptive sense is you got to see it to know it. You know, you got to run the tape of an emergent event, and then you can say, look what just happened. I mean, it's even hard to describe to people what happens in a simple emergence model, a simulation. Most of the time, I find myself, I just have to go and show them. You know,
Conway's
here, look at this net logo
loaders.
Thing, because when I try to describe it narratively, it, you know, it sounds silly. Well, these little things do this and they do that, and then, you know, it's because of these rules, and it's much easier to show.
But I think it's worth distinguishing two senses of predictability here, because, I mean, you mentioned just higher up. I mean, we do know some counterfactuals. If the storm had been Category 1, none of this would have happened. But that doesn't mean we can predict what would happen if it was Category 5, I mean, in advance. I mean, so there's things that one can say counterfactually, even, or you know, maybe other things as well, so that there are things one can predict, but that doesn't mean that what happened was predictable, right? I mean, and
well,
so I think that might help with this idea of distinguishing between all these different competing nodes in the network, and maybe ones where you can say.
But it's not entirely clear, I think, even if it had been a Category 1, that none of this would have happened, and
that
some of the levee collapses that they're looking at now appear to actually be structural problems with the levees. Not that, in one, at least two of them apparently didn't get topped initially. What happened is the earth underneath them got pulled out and they started to collapse. The Industrial Canal one, apparently a boat got driven through it. It could have happened even in a Category 1
but
storm.
But the other part of it is that, I mean, we know from other events that at least some of the cascade of things that happened post-Katrina, you don't need a hurricane for. For example, if there had been a Category 1 hurricane and the power had gone out in New Orleans, a lot of, you know, you could very well argue that the looting probably, at least some degree, would have happened, and a whole bunch of other things would have happened, and all you needed to do really was knock out the power.
And then maybe evacuate a bunch of people as well, right? So you have sort of empty streets and empty shops.
Right. So there, you know, there again, back to the sort of issue of proximate cause, I don't think you can do that.
In fact, I mean, in a way, if you want, you know, one of the principal policy-making figures of the last say, 10 to 15 years, who actually had an emergent philosophy of social order, it would actually be Giuliani, right? In other words, who was operating off of social scientists and so on. But the broken window theory of crime is essentially an emergent theory, but it says this small thing is generative of very big things. Maybe it's right, maybe it's not, you know, but it was an attempt to sort of make this case that there's this little thing that doesn't appear to have any direct connection to the big things that people worry about. But it means even in this circumstance, it would be hard to be certain about what the little things are that produce the it.
I'm not so much interested in trying to prevent all possible disasters, but I think maybe emergence has something to say about when one happens, what can you do in the moment to try to cause the outcome to go a different way.
And I'm even interested in not just what can you do to change the final shape of the complex structure that's hardening in place, but what can you do to mitigate once it's actually sort of appeared. So I was looking a lot at people that sort of have tried to actually use some of this literature or some of these kinds of ideas to think about policy and strategies. And I don't know, we actually haven't talked, I think, about Perrow's work. This essay I found by him on Katrina, this written is actually sort of really banal, unfortunately. It's just like, you know, it's actually Michael Brown's fault. So much for that. But I mean, his larger literature on normal accidents, he's done stuff on Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, a whole host of failures. And the argument is exactly this kind of network argument that this is a cascade of very, you know, lots of very small errors, all of them preventable, that hit a kind of tipping point and create a situation far worse. So like in Three Mile Island, one of the things that he did when he wrote about it was that, you know, that was an early decision in the management of it in which these guys were actually reading their instruments wrong. And so that they applied a solution that was the exact opposite of what they should have been applying. So he said, you know, they understood the situation actually accurately, but they misunderstood the basically what the indicators, the direction of their indicators was. So they sort of went the exact opposite direction and made it vastly worse. When they made it vastly worse, they created a new problem that it then took them hours to understand existed. And by that time, they'd actually ruined one of their instruments. So I mean, so that, you know, this kind of small cascades of small errors leading up to some very big error. The problem is in his argument, as I see it, once you hit that point of phase transition in a cascade of errors, that's it. You know, then you're just dealing with mitigation of a big bad situation. There's no undoing it. And the problem is that it's difficult to figure out how to engineer a recognition of the little things that are the critical points of vulnerability or failure.
And doesn't emergence tell us we can't know ahead of time? That's
yeah,
what
no, but
to get
but
at.
But in fact, it, I mean, it's an interesting thing to pursue because as a general phenomenon, if one thinks of these singular events, catastrophes, as largely a consequence of particular configurations of a small number of a large number of variables with feedback between them, that is, they're connected systems, and that's where this cascade idea comes from. A quick idea is when you are close to a catastrophic situation, what you want to do is, to the extent possible, remove all feedback from the system, damp the system.
That's what Perrow sort of argues.
That would be.
Okay, so apply that to New Orleans.
Sort of
how do you damp the system when it's
okay,
already
in
damped?
In fact, no, very, very, very relevant.
That was Joe. You got
very relevant to New Orleans because in order to damp the system in New Orleans, what would have been necessary is to have put enough local supply caches and enough local authority so that as soon as the system began to fall apart, everybody fell back into units of no more than 10 or 100 people
that took care of themselves,
that were self-supplying and self-sustaining. So if, in fact, you really wanted to design a city to survive
catastrophe, so you're actually cutting the feedback to the larger.
You would design the
right
city so that, as necessary,
it could be disaggregated.
All larger interdependences would be broken.
So by this argument,
like,
for example,
Tokyo.
The big mistake is
Tokyo?
The Superdome and Convention Center.
That's
so
true.
You're
yep.
aggregating
yep.
people
yep.
in
we'll
one place where
problems.
You create a supply crisis, but also you create a massive feedback loop of people concerned about their supplies, cut off from any sense of local knowledge of the environment,
sure.
yeah.
in an unfamiliar place, with the media representing them to them, right back at them, you know. I mean, so that was the big mistake.
Sure.
In that
is that even feasible?
Huh?
Is that even feasible? It seems to me that
nuclear shelters in the 50s, people put.
The nuclear shelters in the 50s were, in fact,
well,
an example of this.
Saying.
That was an effort to make them.
I'm guessing. What my question is, that's all well and good to say, okay, you guys, 10 to 100 people, but then you're saying that they're not going to interact with the other groups.
You're gonna set the system up so that, I mean, this isn't an effort to deny interdependences.
Right,
I believe in interdependences, and there need to be a whole series of interactions among levels of organization. But if you were really serious about trying to minimize catastrophes like New Orleans, where there's a feedback among things that's contributing to catastrophe, what you would do is design your systems so that you can quickly disconnect all the parts.
I just point
out that permanent.
That just seems like it would delay the inevitable.
I just point out that's the way neighborhoods are structured in Tokyo. You have a small block with its own police station. There's not even an address, and there could be communication, but really people.
It's also the system that terrorists use. I mean, it's the terrorist cell system.
Yeah, as a self is penetrated,
want
it quickly severs its links to all others.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
I mean, it's designed that way. I mean, but this is, I mean, you can think about, to some extent, this is what people who have been looking at the positive side of emergence in New Orleans have been observing. For example, there's a way in which you could argue that looting at some levels in some places was precisely this, that it was small neighborhood groups securing the supplies, or for that matter, in certain cases, police, securing the supplies that they needed for themselves.
Sure.
There was an account in the New York Times of a neighborhood that's not far from the French Quarter, so of course it was above, the French Quarter is actually one of the highest places in the city, and it never did get that flooded. Where the entire neighborhood, essentially, everybody was still in their houses, and what they'd done was that they'd gone out as groups to secure food, booze, a few other things, and that they were all just sort of watching each other, and they had posted a, you know, they had a regular rotating guard to the neighborhood, who had the neighborhood shotgun, and that was it, you know. And so you could sort of say, if you tried to institutionalize that, as opposed to make it something that just happens spontaneously in some circumstances.
But that's what we did too. We did have local government, state government, and federal government. We have these levels.
The scale was still too low.
I thought that's what people were pointing at as being the problem.
No.
Yes, because the local government was looking for the state government. The state
that's
government
exactly
was looking
right.
for the federal
I mean,
government.
Could,
the federal government
make an
was looking
argument
for the local
that,
government.
That at its
God.
Root, the failure in
yeah.
New Orleans is indicative of a broader failure in American society. Which is a failure to appreciate the necessary interaction between local control and federal control. Essentially, in New Orleans, we were seeing an example of systems where the ability to control locally has atrophied because of expectations of federal control, which in fact the federal government is not prepared to satisfy. And that applies to a large number of other phenomena in the United States.
I think Louisiana especially.
I don't know, Bryn Mawr College especially.
Well, I mean, and there were some of the other people I look at. I mean, Schneier, I don't know if anybody's seen his stuff on security. I mean, he's previously done a lot of stuff on cryptography and computer security, and he's kind of an interesting guy. He wrote a book before this book, Beyond Fear, that's just about computer security, where he said, you know, you come to the realization that you could never have a technical solution to computer security because people were the ones who were screwing up everything. People that threw away their passwords or used their own names as passwords or whatever. I mean, that was always going to be the vulnerability, so that you had to have a sense of how are people systemically connected in their use of technology or their use of space if you had wanted to have any kind of security answers. So in this book, a lot of the, I mean, about half the book is basically just kind of waste space. I mean, we stay the same things again and again. But a lot of it is, when he gets into the second half, into kind of real design questions, he has these ideas that, you know, decentralization, localization, networks that fail well, I mean, that in a sense have a designed brittleness to them,
sure.
at points of failure, so that they actually firewall off, automatically firewall off the areas that have failed.
Sure.
You know, it's a little like, also like ship design, I mean, the idea that you want to have
bulkheads
and you want to have compartments that flood, and when they flood, they just flood on their own.
It's a parachute principle.
Yeah.
But it's also, of course, it is what's the explicit
parachutes.
Principle for development of the web. The internet web was originally based on a demand from the Defense Department that it needed to be a system that would fail gracefully, would not be dependent on it.
But he's talking about the internet.
Yeah, the old ARPANET.
Yeah,
idea.
So the whole notion,
that was the whole
point. Notion that no node shall be critical was designed into the internet from the beginning.
Which is part of the problem with controlling it, if you wanted to tax it or
eliminate the problem with controlling it or one of its great virtues.
Yes,
it's both things, right? In other words, again, this is the scale-free network problem. That it's intensely robust in the face of random attacks or
single
problems.
Random attacks.
It's intensely vulnerable in the case of highly targeted attacks that look at a heavily connected node.
Yes. Well, that's something we haven't mentioned, is if you really had a system that could deal with a flood, what would be the results of having this system in place all the time?
Yeah.
You might have little groups of people decide that they're going to take over the local neighborhood and it's time to get some food.
That's why I say it is, in fact, a problem of balance between local and global interactions. And part of the reason why we've got this screwy over-dependence on global interactions that can't serve the function is that people got worried about too much local.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think Louisiana is, this is part of the urban theory, had particularly bad local government, particularly small local government. I mean, actually, if you look at, I didn't do the number, but when I saw the total number of policemen, forgetting about whether they're corrupt or not, for the entire city of New Orleans, divide, put that numerator, put the population denominator, it seemed to me like incredibly small.
It
seemed like they had like 1,000, the whole police force is like 1,800 people or something. The city's 400,000 people or something. I mean, that's like,
there's a big literature on this, but the historical and political science literature, but state governments in the South since the 1920s have actually had far smaller capacity. I mean, just pure resources.
So you were in a situation where you had a local government
than the North
that was dependent on the federal government precisely because it was this tiny government, and of course, you're absolutely right to say the federal government can't rescue anybody given its current structure. So but like it had it happened in a, and you know, this guy John Tierney, some people hate, but he talked about North Carolina and their preparations, and they're just much more ready, their own local government. I mean, this was a conservative critique, it's the problem of the locals, but he said here's all the plans they have, so they have all the, they're not depending on FEMA to rescue them at all in the initial phase, and that's what these guys should have been doing too. Now, I don't think that's the whole, I think that he's wrong to think that's the whole issue, but I think they were particularly inept at the local level, that's because they're just such a small government. They took so long. I mean, like, look at Alabama had the governor, it's not related to this, but with respect to education and financing education, they put an amendment on the ballot that was like totally sensible, completely rational. The population voted it down completely, and just because it would have been a more equitable distribution of taxes, and poor people who would have had lower taxes under this system because it would have been more equitable voted against it, and the thing fell. It was really just nothing wrong with this plan at all. This was really a good idea, and it wasn't much of a bigger government. It was a tiny bit more money for education. It was just a more equitable distribution of the costs. So they just have a history down there of no government.
If we had lost the Civil War, that was all about states' rights.
But the tension here, in part, it seems to me, is if we accept. I mean, I found there's a whole bunch of people, and this guy that's talking about fourth generation counterinsurgent warfare has a lot of the same recommendations. But if we were to say, look, let's design systems that fail well, that are designed to break into dampened, to break their connections to a network in the case of failure. One of the things that you have to accept about that as a solution that I think makes most of us uncomfortable is that to some extent you lose any capacity to manage what is happening in any given broken cell of a network any node.
And so you really have to hand that over.
So if one node, turns out to be Lord of the Flies and the next one turns out to be Utopia, in designing this, you accept that. You simply say, there is no way to manage that from above as a design consideration. What happens in the node once they break can't be dealt with until you are in a position to safely begin to reconnect the nodes.
Exactly, that's correct. And it seems to me that may, in some ways, be, I mean, we started back at the beginning of this with the discussion about intelligent design and all that stuff. This may be the key link, is people are really uncomfortable with the idea that there would ever be circumstances in which some higher authority is not in control.
You're saying that's the missing link?
I'm saying at some very deep level, it is precisely this issue of people's discomfort with the notion that there would ever be circumstances in which there is no higher control over them.
But
you raise it, I think, in a very legitimate sense. Yes, we would have to be able to say, under some circumstances, we're going to leave to a local group the decision as to whether to eat each other. Yes.
But I mean,
that's,
you know, the other
that's the,
no,
story.
The other part
no.
of it is, you know, you leave. I mean, we did see this in a sense.
No, because
you look at these,
the
you know, you look at these little rural communities. Let's forget New Orleans. You look at these little rural communities. That was a node, and the system broke down, and the node was sitting there, you know, self-imploded, and it was a node. But everybody was focused in on New Orleans, which was a much more attractive node. And
look at Rita, right? I mean, now that they're getting into certain kinds of areas, they're finding out Rita actually really messed up some small rural towns, but they're not connected to the network. In other words, they're not highly connected nodes. So frankly, no story is being told in the wake of that in which Rita is an incredible disaster. Those nodes were left to fail on their own, so to speak, and nobody at the time reacted to their failure as something that required a story of disaster unparalleled. Now people, you know, somebody can go in and say, wow, look at this, but it, in a sense, doesn't change the story told about Rita after Rita happened, which was, oh, not such a big deal.
Well, that might be more useful than having, like, these color scales of emergency. I mean,
big deal, big deal.
You could have levels of, this is serious, so disconnect every person from themselves.
Exactly.
But notice, okay,
which would legalize
it.
Would you do a firewall between science and religion?
It's interesting.
It's
a practical problem, political problem right there.
No.
It requires saying that Billings is less important than New York, which when it comes to allocating federal monies in particular, given the design of the federal government, is actually a very difficult thing to say in purely political terms, even if a completely dry empirical description of a network makes it clear that New York is a highly connected node and Billings is not.
Yeah. It also has, I mean, I was suddenly thinking about sort of the implications of this new design principle. Everybody, when there's an emergency, you're supposed to turn to the radio and listen to the statements that are being made generally to very large numbers of people. This alternate approach would say,
turn off
in case
radio.
Of an emergency, turn off the fucking radio and look to the people immediately around you for support.
But then you wouldn't know that the levy had been
breached.
Which,
in fact, I think would make a hell of a lot more sense.
Well,
but
know
you might.
Anyway.
You might. I mean, in other words, if you think about what happened in some of these small nodes, in fact, I don't know if anybody was reading during Katrina, there was a weblog, actually I should have linked to it on this, by a guy who called himself the Inner Diary. I don't know what was his name for it beforehand, but he turned out to be a guy he was a computer network specialist.
He was up on
a high floor, and so his ability to maintain connections to the web stayed sound through the whole thing. So he was updating this constantly with, you know, I see out my window, this is what's happening, we went out to get supplies for people, we've been talking with, and so on. I mean, that he became a kind of link between a local node of people coping in his building, about 20 to 30 people, and some outside thing. So what you might want to do is not have everybody turn off their radios, but have one person keep the radio on.
Well, you don't want to depend on it.
Yeah.
And maybe even not too much, because he may have been lying.
Yeah, that's right. No, for outsiders, it's a whole other matter altogether again. But he was the person filtering information in to the people in his building and his area about what everybody else was saying. So he told people, you know, this level.
So the disaggregation can't be too small. Like the New York Times yesterday had that article about all those people who decided to stay and died. And they would, I mean, and the way the narrative was told was they thought their house was safe, you know, or they didn't want their autistic children to be made fun of at the Superdome. So they stayed in their house, and then they got wiped out. So they disaggregated.
The disaggregation does not assure anybody's survival. Understand, I'm not promoting disaggregation as a way of security.
Just reduces the larger.
I'm saying the disaggregation reduces the part of the problem that has to do with feedback. It keeps the system from becoming the problem.
In fact, you almost accept, again, if this is the design,
some
nodes
will
fail.
In fact, they have to.
They will.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no question.
And whose idea was this, that a design system will fail well?
Oh, lots of. I mean, that's what I think is interesting, is that if you look around, there's lots of people with lots of different systems. Or talking about that as an idea.
That seems really...
Security, warfare, you know, watching...